You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, January 26th, 2023. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder. And this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Hal Weitzman, editor-in-chief of the Chicago Booth Review and author of What's the Matter with Delaware? How the First State Has Favored the Rich, Powerful, and Criminal, and How It Costs Us All. Come on, man.
Come on.
Come on. And later in the show, Lee Harris, staff writer at the American Prospect, will be joining us to discuss her latest piece on Wall Street's attempts to infiltrate Green New Deal initiatives. Meanwhile, Israeli forces murdered 9 Palestinians in their latest raid of the West Bank, including a 60-year-old woman. That's 29 killings so far this year in less than a month, including at least 5 children. There are also reports that say that Israeli forces fired tear gas inside of a pediatric hospital ward. Adam Schiff has announced his intention to run for Feinstein's Senate seat in 2024. Katie Porter, Barbara Lee, hash this out, please. We need a unified front against that goober. U.S. GDP rose nearly 3% in the final quarter of 2022. Now wages, please. Obama-era advisors are already publicly panicking about the debt ceiling. The same ones who wanted to cut Medicare and Social Security to appease Republicans. Thanks, but no thanks for your input. Kevin McCarthy's bigoted campaign to remove Ilhan Omar from the Foreign Affairs Committee is hitting a snag, since a move on that specific committee requires a full House vote. The Supreme Court has issued its first opinion of the term, and it's a unanimous decision that sides against disabled veterans who are seeking compensation for their injuries. 4 state legislatures are considering bills that would ban transition care into young adulthood, including making it a felony to provide care up until the age of 26 in South Carolina and Oklahoma. A new lawsuit has been brought by pharmaceutical companies, the ones that manufacture abortion pills, challenging state bans on their drugs. The Biden administration has banned logging in Alaska's largest national forest, also North America's largest temperate rainforest. A group of left-leaning legislators in Peru have filed a motion to impeach President Dina Boluarte over her handling of protests in the wake of the ousting of Pedro Castillo. Dozens have been killed. And lastly, Meta has officially reinstated Trump's Facebook and Instagram accounts. Oh boy, all this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, a Majority Report. I mean, I got to get that branding in there, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, you're leaving money on the table.
Because at the show, there were people donning a Majority Report shirts.
There was.
It was very, I took a photo of it and I went to look back on it, very blurry. Very blurry.
Shout out to a fellow from Connecticut, I believe it was,
yes,
who had the M Majority shirt on.
I was very appreciative of that, and we got to get that back up in the merch store, because who knows how far we can go with that branding. I realized that since we were talking about Marvel movies, we did not decide on which clip we wanted to start with.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
So maybe we can just start with one, since I headlined it. Kevin McCarthy is trying to get rid of Ilhan Omar on the with her committee assignments. And right now he's hitting a bit of a bump because at the very least on the Foreign Affairs Committee, you need a full House vote. And this is just a bit of a preview of what he's going to have to deal with largely, given the incredibly slim margins that the Republicans have in the House. His capacity to get rid of her might be limited because, as I mentioned, you need a full House vote, and hopefully the Democrats stand behind her. They haven't really announced a replacement or someone that would, fill her seat on the committee. But, I mean, I'm semi-surprised by that, given their willingness and enthusiasm to throw her under the bus, largely calling her anti-Semitic, condemning her when she's nothing of the sort.
But I will just say, like, Ilhan also knows how to play these parliamentary games, I think, as well as anybody, particularly on the squad. She has history of that in Minnesota. And
House
so, and she's been taking votes that aren't particularly votes that I'm certainly happy with, and our worst votes. I wish I had the, could remember this, maybe I'll look it up for after, but votes that, like, AOC is taking better votes on, particularly on, like, foreign policy stuff. And I think it's because she's strengthening her position in the party to, fight off this attack.
So here she is responding to reports that McCarthy might actually try to hold this floor vote to remove her from the House Foreign Affairs Committee.
Our democracy and our governing bodies rest on a healthy and vibrant debate. Our strength lies not in our perfection, but in the diversity of our voices and our openness to civil discourse. That is why, whatever our disagreements might be as members of Congress, policy differences alone have not and must not be cause for eliminating someone from serving on a committee. In modern American history, the punishment of stripping a member of Congress of their committee assignments has been reserved for only the most egregious wrongdoings. Those convicted or indicted on corruption, those who have engaged in bribery, sexual misconduct, encouraged violence, or other grave charges. I have served on the House Foreign Affairs Committee and the House Education and Labor Committee for the past two terms, committees that I have lived experience and expertise in. As a child who survived war, lived in a refugee camp, I would have never imagined that I would one day have the opportunity to serve on a subcommittee on Africa, global health, and global human rights. I would not have believed that I would one day not just serve as the first African-born member of Congress, but on a committee that oversees policies towards the continent. Kevin McCarthy's purely partisan move to strip us from our committee is not only a political stunt, but also a blow to the integrity of our democratic institution and threat to our national security. We are thankful to Leader Jeffries and House Democrats, and even some courageous Republicans, for standing with us. If McCarthy wants to denigrate the integrity of the House and its committees, we will always stand up to these efforts. I am grateful for the confidence of my constituents and my colleagues have shown me to serve on these committees, and I look forward to continuing that work of building a more peaceful world.
The reality is that while Kevin McCarthy is trying to oust a handful of lawmakers from their positions, including Eric Swalwell and Adam Schiff, those former two have to do with, like, Adam Schiff's public-facing connection with the Trump impeachment. Swalwell, his connection to, you know, right-wing larger conspiracies about China. That's the reasoning behind those. Ilhan Omar, it's just all bigotry. Bigotry. And he sees an opening here because apparently Josh Gottheimer and Jared Moskowitz, who have accused her of anti-Semitism in the past, are being a bit lukewarm on whether or not they'll support her in a floor vote. But
despicable.
I mean, exactly. Nancy Mace has, I guess, said that she doesn't agree with this tactic. Another Republican, Spartz from Indiana, has said that she would oppose the measure as well. The reason that Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar were removed from committees in 2021 was because they tried to overturn the Democratic result. And Marjorie Taylor Greene, I guess it was a little earlier because of her conspiracy theories. But Gosar in 2021 was because he was supportive of a coup in our government. And that is the bare minimum amount of accountability that those guys should have faced. They should have been, frankly, criminally prosecuted. And if we were a functioning country, that would have been the case. But what drives this with Ilhan Omar is pure bigotry. The fact that she's one of the few Muslim members of Congress, the fact that she chooses to speak clearly and openly against Israeli apartheid, and also the fact that her presence on these committees, it's a stain on American exceptionalism, given how she...
I mean, watch the video of her.
About it.
Watch
yeah.
the video of her grilling Elliot Abrams, right?
Right.
And that's exactly why, like these, and Elliot Abrams is still very much welcome part of the foreign policy community, the bipartisan blob in D.C., which is crazy to have Ilhan there. And it was regarding the China committee. Ilhan voted in support of it when Jamal Bowman said things like, "This is Cold War." And I think that's just because Ilhan has previously taken heat for saying we should have more cooperation with China. So I think, you know, she's playing a game here.
Yeah,
I respect her a lot and think it is like, you know. Again, like you said, I'm not a huge Schiff fan, and if we have to sacrifice Schiff, the only worry I have is it makes him more of a martyr, and then he's going to be even more of a hero among Democrats.
Well, at the same time, hopefully, when in his run for Senate, he has a little less free publicity on any committee to make a name for himself.
Yeah. A little bit resentful of that sort of publicity-seeking behavior on the part of Schiff.
Yeah. Anyway, support Ilhan Omar, and if this floor vote actually happens, I'm going to be looking very hard at who votes yes and no on the Democratic side, and if Gottheimer actually sticks to his word, just another piece of evidence about what kind of guy he is. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Hal Weitzman, editor-in-chief of the Chicago Booth Review and author of What's the Matter with Delaware. We'll be right back. We are back, and we are joined now by Hal Weitzman, editor-in-chief of the Chicago Booth Review, author of What's the Matter with Delaware? How the First State Has Favored the Rich, Powerful, and Criminal, and How It Costs Us All. Hal, thanks so much for coming on today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for inviting me on.
Of course. So just some staggering statistics that I was not aware of until researching for this interview in your book. I did not realize that Delaware, one of the smallest states in the country, has 2/3 of U.S. public companies registered there, let alone private companies. And there are way more corporations than people in the state. I mean, I knew that it was the place to incorporate, and you know, the Biden is the credit card senator, and that's where he was from, but I did not know how massive it was. I guess we can just start there, the sheer volume of corporations in the state of Delaware.
Yeah, I mean, so you put your finger on it. 2/3 of the biggest companies in America, the Fortune 500, are incorporated in Delaware. Of course, that doesn't mean they're actually there. This is a legal fiction. It means that they have a registration in Delaware. And we can talk a little bit more, if you want, about what that means. But most companies of any size that are listed in the United States are incorporated or officially registered in the state of Delaware. As you said, Delaware has a population of just over 1 million people. So it's about the size of the Grand Rapids or Tucson metro area. But it has 1.8 million corporations that are legally there. Now, as I said, they're not physically there. You don't have to go to Delaware to register in Delaware. We can talk a little bit about the process, but these are not companies that have a physical location necessarily in Delaware, but they are officially registered in there and you know, get various variety of benefits from being there. So it's not just the credit cards, as you say, it's a whole variety of companies that you and I use every day. It's impossible to avoid Delaware. Delaware is everywhere. Think about, you know, just Google and Amazon and Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter and Visa or MasterCard or your phone, Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, Sprint. Delaware is the corporate air that we all breathe. If you're a consumer, then a lot of your day you are dealing with companies that are registered in Delaware. So it's really a huge part of the capitalist system. But as you say, because it's small, it kind of flies under the radar. We don't think a lot about Delaware. And that's what drew me as a writer to this story, was that it seemed very unexplored.
Well, its size, I think, is key to understanding Delaware, right? I mean, would it be safe to call Delaware a version of the Cayman Islands, except just domestically? Because it seems like there's something about the size of the state or a country that, relative to the others in its wheelhouse or in its proximity, that incentivizes, say, tax havens, corporate dodging, et cetera. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, I mean, the size, so it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's no coincidence that countries that we think of as, and let's go beyond tax, right? Because tax is one aspect of it, but kind of secrecy jurisdictions, they tend to be smallish places, as you say, in the Western Hemisphere, that sort of, you know, sort of Panama, various small Caribbean islands, and then in Europe, places like Cyprus or the Isle of Man. So yes, the places tend to be small. And I think partly that's because it's easy to get everyone together. The elite tends to be pretty small in a small place. I mean, it tends to be pretty small in a big place, but even smaller in a small place. So it's easy to get everyone together. And often small places don't have big capacity to produce, let's say, manufacturing exports and things like that. So in Delaware's case, the size and the location is really important, right? It's not stuck out where, like, Wyoming, which is a state that would like to compete with Delaware, but is not very near the New York law firms and the corporate headquarters in Manhattan and New Jersey. So the location is really favorable as well, being so close to kind of the big financial and political centers of the United States. So the size helps people get together. It also means that the benefits, and we can talk a little bit about the system, but essentially Delaware has flipped the script on how states raise money. Most states depend on tax revenues. Delaware has a different system. It depends on fees. So each state, each of those 1.8 million
corporations. It's a state structured like some sort of financial institution.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, another way of thinking about it is, you know, your listeners will be familiar with the Bernie Sanders fundraising campaign, how Bernie changed the nature of fundraising so that instead of having a small number of large donors, a la Biden, you have a large number of small donors. And Delaware kind of follows that model, ironically, because it has a lot of corporations registered. None of them individually pays that much. Of course, if you're a big corporation, you pay more. But if you're a small corporation, you don't pay that much less. So they're all paying a relatively small amount of money. But because Delaware is small, that is materially important to Delaware in a way that it wouldn't be important to New York, California, Illinois.
Yeah, you write about the, quote, incorporation industry. And that churn is really fascinating to me. Can you expand a little more on what the process is for registering corporations in Delaware, the ease, the lack of oversight, accountability, all kind of with the explicit purpose of collecting these fees to run the state?
Well, it's super easy. In fact, you and I could set up a limited liability company in Delaware before the end of recording this podcast. And we wouldn't need to go to Delaware to do it.
Should we do that as an exercise? No, I'm just
actually
kidding.
There are many, if you look it up, and look, I recount them in the book, there's many people who do NPR have done it and various other people have done it. Yeah. It's very easy to do. You don't have to go to Delaware. You don't have to provide any documentation. So it's easier to get a company in Delaware than to get a library card in Delaware. Because to get a library card, you have to show some form of ID, but you don't need to set up a corporation. And then when we've set it up, and we can still do it because we still have time, when we've set it up, we don't need to put our names on it. We can be anonymous. So we can set up an anonymous corporation. And here's what makes it really convenient, because Delaware has set the whole thing up. You know, you said Delaware is a bit like a financial company. In this sense, Delaware is much more like a financial services firm than a state. It has set its whole machinery up to service business people whenever they want to do this. So the office of the Secretary of State's incorporation office is open till midnight Eastern time. So, you know, so we've got, you can set up an anonymous company within 30 minutes. And I'm told by people who know these kinds of things that if you make the right phone calls, you can do it within more like 10 minutes. You don't need to, it's an anonymous company. We don't need to provide any documentation, and we can do it essentially in the middle of the night. So what kind of people would be interested in that and that setup? It doesn't take a big leap of imagination to show that that's been used for nefarious ends.
Is there any real limitation on foreign incorporation?
Mm-hmm. So this is the part that I find quite scary. I don't know if you've ever written a story or you're researching a story and you cannot quite believe that that's true. So you just have to, before it gets published, you have a little panic attack and you have to double check it. So that happened with me. Having written this book, researched it, and written it over a period of like 5 years, I had a last minute panic and I contacted the Secretary of State in Delaware just to check about this issue about foreign corporations. And the question I asked specifically was, what proportion of the 1.8 million companies registered in Delaware are foreign? By which I mean are controlled by people who are outside the United States, and what proportion are controlled by people within the United States? And they said, we don't know, and there is no way of knowing, because this don't ask, don't tell policy results in a situation where there's no transparency, not only to us, but to them as well. And this has been very frustrating over the years for example, for law enforcement when they're trying to trace international money laundering or drug trafficking or people trafficking. And the trail leads to Delaware. Often that was a cold trail because there was no there. There's nothing to find because they didn't even ask the questions about who controls the companies.
I mean, I want to get into some of the state legislative, the state legislators and where they have dropped the ball, perhaps intentionally, in a bit. But before we get to that, I wanted to go through the history to see how Delaware did become this home for corporations, because you write about this and this is fascinating. I'm from New Jersey, so this could have been me, right? They did take the mantle from New Jersey in the early part of the 20th century, if you don't mind taking us
through
that history.
I'm glad you're asking me this, because I had a review in the Financial Times, my old paper, and they said there was too much history. But I think you have to understand the history, otherwise you don't understand how we got there. And then there's all sorts of narratives about we won. Well, the important part is Delaware didn't get this industry because it had a better business model. It copied the business model that New Jersey had previously had. So the potted version is this. At the end of the 19th century, New Jersey allowed holding companies where one company could own another, essentially. And then it relaxed all sorts of rules on corporate structures. And because of that, all sorts of companies from all over the United States moved to New Jersey officially, legally speaking. And they were attracted by this kind of more lax structure, the ability to do anything via a holding company registered in New Jersey. And so by like 1911, Fees from this business accounted for about a third of New Jersey's state revenues. And other states, particularly Delaware, copied these regulations, but they couldn't get much traction. Then there was the famous election of 1913 when Taft was the president and the people running against him were Woodrow Wilson from your state, your home state, and Teddy Roosevelt. And as part of the campaign, it was a three-way election. Teddy Roosevelt, if you remember, was the progressive candidate. And during the campaign, Teddy Roosevelt kind of barbed Woodrow Wilson saying, you know, you say you want to rein in corporations, but you have all these corporations running around in New Jersey doing what the hell they like. And Woodrow Wilson, of course, wins the election. But during that lame duck period, because he was the governor back in New Jersey, during that period where he's transitioning from being the governor to being the president, he went back to New Jersey with this kind of zeal to reform the system. And he and his allies in the legislature passed a whole load of bills that basically neutered the ability to do this holding corporation scheme and tightened up the rules about corporate structures. And the business, as had been predicted, fled New Jersey and went to neighboring Delaware, which hadn't done anything innovative other than copy what New Jersey was doing. And of course, Delaware welcomed all these companies with open arms. So it kind of picked up this crown that New Jersey had deliberately thrown down. And now the situation is the same for Delaware. Now corporate fees account for about and associated revenues like abandoned property, gift cards that you didn't spend all the money on, all that money cumulatively that goes to Delaware accounts for about 40% of its state budget. So it needs this business. That goes back to the size. It needs this business. It cannot afford to do anything that might threaten this so valuable source of revenue.
It's fascinating. And this is a bit of an aside, but I'm curious if you have any thoughts on this also being a time when before this business fled New Jersey, there was a lot of organized crime and corruption within the state and state governments. Is that a coincidence in your mind? Did you come across any of that in your research?
You mean so organized crime in Delaware?
Well, in Jersey, because now I feel this is a much more white collar version of like, say, what's being depicted in Boardwalk Empire, right, or something like that.
Oh, that's a great question. I don't know. I'm not able to shed much light on that. Maybe I'll write a book about New Jersey next. And then
there you go.
You can advise me on that one.
So another thing you talk about there, you call the industry essentially where businesses are created the franchise. How do you define that? What does the franchise within Delaware entail?
Well, I didn't come up with that phrase, the franchise. Gotcha. That's what they call it. They call it the franchise, which is shorthand for the system whereby companies are registered in Delaware, the legal infrastructure, which is a little complex, but they have specific business court, a chancery court. So when you see about cases, the most recent high profile one being Twitter versus Musk, these take place in the chancery court, specific dedicated court for business cases, which means everything's more efficient, more effective, and supposedly has a lot of expertise and predictability and case law. So a lot of stuff you can do your research about. So that's part of it. There's a bankruptcy system. So Delaware makes a lot of money through its bankruptcy courts. All of this feeds back. You know, I say in the book that Delaware is like the closest thing that America has to a corporate version of the registrar of births, marriages, and deaths. So companies go there to be born, in other words, to get registered. They go there to get married, if you will. Here the analogy is starting to fall apart, or get divorced or have beefs with each other, because that's where the courts come in, and then deaths because of bankruptcy. So all of that collectively is called the franchise. Plus, and I mentioned this a little bit earlier, a very nice little side business, which is abandoned property. So if you have a few cents in a bank account or overpaid a credit card and there's a few cents there, or a couple of dollars in a stock trading account or crypto account or whatever, and that company is registered in Delaware, that so-called abandoned property, because after a few years that money is declared legally abandoned, that reverts to the state of Delaware. And states do various things with those. Most of them hold it in a separate account and look for the people who actually own the money. But Delaware just spends that money. And that's a nice $500 million a year business for Delaware, abandoned property. So all of that taken together is considered to be the franchise. And as I say, financially, that is so important for Delaware. And it's important for Delawareans because it's estimated that Delawareans only pay about 50 cents on the dollar for every dollar of service they receive. So they call it, let me get my colors right, because I think it's a red, is that right? Red is Republican. So red, yeah. Taxing state, red, it's a red taxing state with blue spending. So Every politician's dream, low taxes, high spending, and a lot of that is paid for with corporate fees.
I mean, the franchise tax as well. Can you talk about that as well? What that entails and like essentially the tax that bridges the gap that you described there.
Yeah. So as I say, it's a pile them high and sell them cheap type business. High volume, costs a few $100s. We still have time if you want to create that corporation before the end of the podcast. But if we do it, we have to pay a fee, depending on how quickly we want to do it. And the fee that we would pay to set up a limited liability company, you've probably heard of those, right? Limited liability companies account for about 70% of all the companies that are set up in Delaware. And there are about 1,000 companies being set up every day in Delaware. So 700 of those, more or less, are limited liability companies on average. So the rest are so-called, I mean, it's a little technical, but C corporations, like the big listed companies that were, you know, the sort of, I was thinking of Bath and Body Works, you know, these kind of, or whoever, the big MasterCards and everyone else, they are C corporations. They pay higher fees, but most of what's set up is a pretty low fee. In other words, a few $100s for the basic level of service. But if you aggregate all that up, it adds up to a significant amount of revenue for Delaware, you know, probably close nowadays to about $2 billion in fees alone, which for a small state like Delaware is extremely significant. And as I say, add in all these adjunct source streams of revenue, you get to about 40% of the state budget. And they really have, as I said earlier, flipped the script. So Delaware collects more in corporate fees than 42 other United States collect in corporate taxes. So they have completely changed the model. Very innovative, not very easy to copy. There's several other states that would like to, like Nevada, but they haven't been able to. But they have completely flipped the script and made themselves financially much more secure. But having said that, if there's any sniff from regulators or the federal government that this might be shut down, it would be financially disastrous for Delaware.
Yeah, I mean, and you talk about the relative proximity to New York and stuff giving it an advantage. Delaware, close to D.C. as well, and that's, I guess, where we can move in a second. But I did want to ask you also about the preponderance of single-use LLCs. Mm. So this was something I wasn't aware of, right? I mean, you just talked about LLCs and how ubiquitous they are, how widely used they are. But I didn't even know that there's something where you can essentially, it's like a disposable LLC where you can use it one time and throw it away. And that exists in Delaware as well, if you don't mind talking a bit more about
it. Yeah,
that.
And not just Delaware, to be fair, anywhere. I mean, it's like a plastic straw. You're absolutely right. So if you and I wanted to use our new LLC in Delaware to bring some money over from wherever, South America, we would do that transaction through using the LLC, and then we might basically abandon it. Next year, we've got to pay our fees again. We might decide we don't pay the fees. The challenge here as an academic, because I am at University of Chicago, so I'm trying to approach this as a little bit in an academic way and look for data. The challenge is there isn't a lot of data on single use versus, you know, repeated use. So we don't know. I have heard just anecdotally from my sources in Delaware that there's a lot of this single use, which makes sense because if we want to do a one-off transaction, we wouldn't necessarily want to use that LLC again. And because of the nature of limited liability, if we were to do an additional transaction, we might not want any fallout from the first transaction to affect the second. And that's often how limited liability is popular, exactly for that reason. I'll give you a more kind of prosaic example. I'm sure many of us have stayed at an Airbnb. Airbnbs increasingly are registered as single limited liability companies. And what you've probably experienced if you have stayed at an Airbnb is that you try and call the owner and there isn't an owner. It's a company in New Jersey or wherever, and they control 55 Airbnbs all over the country. And each one of them is an individual LLC. Now, one of the reasons I found out about that is because a little quirky thing that happens in Delaware, LLCs are so important to Delaware that in some places they are allowed to vote in elections. They are allowed to vote in special elections. So in Newark, Delaware, as they pronounce it locally, they had a special election. And they, under the rules that they have, each LLC can vote separately, which enabled one person to vote 31 times in that special election because they had 31 individual properties, each of them registered as a separate LLC. So this LLC thing is very widely used. And as far as I know, quite a lot of it is used as single use, which, as you say, for Delaware itself means that they got to sell, which gives the whole industry a little bit of a Ponzi
right
aspect to it.
So if I'm hearing you right, LLCs statutorily are allowed to vote in elections in Newark, Delaware? I just want to emphasize that again.
Special elections, yeah. And I write also in Rehoboth Beach, where our president has his second home. Yeah, the LLCs can vote, companies can vote because they're property owners. Think about it. You know, the property is owned by an LLC. So just as an individual property owner might be able to register to vote, the LLC can vote in special elections, not in the... Now, there was a proposal, in which is why I wrote about it, in Rehoboth Beach, which is the resort where lots of people from D.C. have summer homes, that there was a proposal in Rehoboth Beach that they'd be allowed to vote in all elections, but that was not popular, so it was dropped. But still, in special elections, things like tax raising elections, they are LLCs are allowed to vote. Yeah, so you had one individual voting 31 times.
I mean, man, corporations are people, according to the Supreme Court, but that really takes it to a whole nother level. You just mentioned Biden there, and I think it's important that I ask you about it. I mean, this is his state. He served as the senator for one of the two senators from Delaware for nearly two decades, from the early 70s until he became vice president. You know, he's been called the credit card senator. I think his reluctance to relieve student debt is deeply tied to his ties to these kinds of corporations and credit card companies' moneyed interests. And I also think that Chris Coons, his the current person who holds that Senate seat, and I think Biden has really tried to make him in his image, holds many of these attitudes as well. In your research into Delaware, what was Biden's explicit connection to this kind of industry or Ponzi scheme of LLCs and incorporation, as you discuss? And his attitude towards it?
So I would say that he didn't create the system. I mean, it's been around for over 100 years. But he is very much a creature of the system. So if you look at, as you say, his voting record, and in the book I also talk about his voting record on busing, which is related to attitudes in Delaware as well, and the more conservative aspects of Delaware's politics around race relations are reflected in its attitude towards corporations as well. I mean, it's no coincidence that states that used to be slave-owning states, like Delaware, tend to be more conservative to when it comes to businesses as well. So that's one aspect. The credit card thing is huge because, as we may have said earlier, 4 out of the 5 biggest credit card companies are located in Delaware. And why briefly? Because in the early 1980s, Delaware invited 2 of the biggest credit card issuers in to write its regulations to make it more favorable to them. And they got rid of all credit interest rate caps, thereby getting rid of all interest rate caps in the whole United States, because any company can just register in Delaware, get around any local interest rate caps. So credit cards are a huge one. But then if you look at who funded Biden's campaign up until he was running with Obama, his Senate, his top donors to his Senate campaigns were all the biggest law firms in Delaware that make the rules, that argue the cases, and that collect the fat fees. And so they live on they are parasites, essentially, and creators of this system. And so they are the big movers and shakers in Delaware. And he very much was funded by that system. So he has had no interest in challenging the system at all. But as you said, the other two senators, Carper, Coons, have also had no interest in challenging the system. If anything, they might have been more strident in defending some of its more nefarious aspects, such as corporate anonymity, in Congress.
Yeah, Chris Coons at Davos last week, just chilling with Sinema and Manchin. He's one of the people that I think gets flies a little bit under the radar, but fills a very similar role that those two do within the Democratic Party.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. So Coons being a great example, everybody's friend, right? Like you said, very much a centrist type figure between the two parties, and Biden's similar kind of character. And they have this system in Delaware, which they call the Delaware Way, which officially means to it, people who like the Delaware Way will say, well, what it means is we all get together on, like, you know, everyone knows each other, and we get together, and we sort things out, which is kind of what Biden has always said. And sometimes it's worked out on Capitol Hill, and sometimes it hasn't. More often probably hasn't than has. But in Delaware, what it really means is that we all know what we want to do, which is keep this system going. And we're going to write rules behind closed doors. We're going to rush them through the state legislature so there's no proper debate. For example, the way that the corporate code gets made in Delaware is that there's a committee of the Delaware Bar that writes changes to the code every year in secret, gives them to the state legislature, which is a part-time body that has no lawyers in it barely and has no capacity to evaluate these changes. So they basically just rubber stamp them. Mm. And then the governor also has no capacity or interest in challenging these or questioning them, and also rubber stamps them. So you have a system where these working lawyers from the Delaware Bar make the rules that they themselves will appear in court under, which can always seem to me like the fox guarding the hen house. So these lawyers are the very ones who've been creating the system, keeping it going. Big law firms based in all around the what used to be called Rodney Square in the middle of Wilmington. And these are the ones who backed Joe Biden for the past 40 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just important, if not uncomfortable, to acknowledge that, because he might have moved past it. He might have been vice president. He might have more progressive people on his staff. But that 40 years of being a creature of that political system is in him still, right? And if you want to understand his instincts or his kind of desires as president, you have to understand that.
I think it's even worse than that. He's proud of it. White House website and look back on some of the speeches and look up where he's mentioned Delaware, he always says proudly, "We're the corporate state," you know. So he's very proud of Delaware's record as a home of corporations. But the dark side of that is anonymous corporations and all the ways they've been misused for, as I say, from money laundering, international crime, drug smuggling, arms smuggling, people trafficking.
Well, Hal Weitzman, I can't recommend this book enough. It's called What's the Matter with Delaware? How the First State Has Favored the Rich, Powerful, and Criminal, and How It Costs Us All. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Same here. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be joined by Lee Harris of The American Prospect. And we are joined now by Lee Harris, staff writer at The American Prospect, whose latest piece is called Wall Street's Big Bet on Rewiring America. Lee, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Emma.
Of course. So your piece starts discussing Ithaca, New York, particularly. But this story is much broader than Ithaca just in and of itself. So if you don't mind starting there, why I guess Ithaca was so important and illustrative of larger trends around climate politics in the country.
Yeah, for sure. So my story more broadly is kind of about how Wall Street is investing in putting clean energy systems into low-income housing. And since the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, created these billions of dollars in clean energy subsidies, banks have gotten really interested in putting heat pumps and solar panels into poor neighborhoods. And on one level, that's something we should probably want, because for decades, private banks have been underinvesting in these poor areas. It's really hard for building owners in inner cities to get loans for building upgrades. But my story kind of looks at, in Ithaca and then more broadly, how these investments are being made with very little public scrutiny or oversight. And in particular, they're being led by this startup that's really secretive about its model. So just to zoom out for a second, like talk about what's happening. Cities are trying to upgrade their buildings to clean energy, right? And this is a huge undertaking. Like the closest analogy is probably the New Deal's rural electrification program, which brought electric transmission lines to really remote parts of the country. And this is even bigger than that. It's not just about building new transmission infrastructure, but overhauling the 130 million buildings in America. Super expensive. And if we do it well, decarbonizing isn't just good for the planet. It also could mean, you know, cheaper heating and cooling and reducing local air pollution for buildings. It means lower rates of asthma and allergies in kids. But it has this huge upfront price tag attached to it. Now, Bernie Sanders' original Green New Deal was a $16 trillion investment, something much more in line with the kinds of investments made during the New Deal. And if we were in that world, we probably would have had whole offices devoted to directing these investments from the federal level with way more investment in local labor forces and more coordination. Sadly, we're not in that world. We're in the world where we got the Inflation Reduction Act, which is a set of tax credits that are run through the IRS. And even with those tax credits, clean energy equipment is still really expensive. So back to my story, enter Block Power, which is this startup I mentioned, the subject of my story. They've signed contracts with a number of big and mid-sized cities across the country, including Denver, Menlo Park, Oakland, Atlanta, and Ithaca, New York. And you can jump in here, but to tell you briefly about the model in Ithaca. Ithaca decided to overhaul all of its buildings at once, which or kind of on an accelerated timeline, which makes sense because it's cheaper if you can do like bulk orders of heat pumps and if you can bring in a bunch of construction crews at the same time. And it considered issuing a bond to make those investments, but it decided that would be too expensive. And instead it brought in Block Power, this tech startup, which has attracted a number of big name investors like Goldman Sachs and the venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz. Ithaca's leadership said that Block Power was willing to provide a lower cost of capital than they would have been able to get by floating a bond. So one of my initial questions for the story was like, especially in this interest rate environment, why are investors getting interested in a fairly complex and untested deal like this with low rates of return? Like the CEO of Block Power told me they're only taking single digit rates of return. Why is Goldman doing this when it could be making a lot more money elsewhere? And I have like a couple potential answers to that from the story, but I'll stop there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is very fascinating. And there's a lot that I want to hit on that you mentioned there. One, how the IRA does not have conditions that would ensure that union workers are set to be working on these kinds of clean energy initiatives, is my understanding. A lot of this is just essentially giveaway to private developers, and it creates a vacuum for venture capital and Goldman Sachs or whatever to fill, as opposed to the much more robust kind of initiatives that you would describe in the New Deal, where that would not be possible. I mean, a lot of what you write about is, I think, the inevitable cracks being filled by these kinds by Wall Street when that could have been done by, say, you know, public funding.
Right. Exactly. This was not inevitably the world we would be living in. But the way that they're making this pitch to investors is really interesting to me because, like I said, they claim at least that investors are only taking single digit interest rates. However, how are they making it attractive? For one thing, Block Power is marketing it as an ESG investment. So ESG is like environmental, social, and corporate governance, I think it stands for. And banks have been marketing ESG as, you know, like climate friendly or fighting racism or whatever, but it's completely unregulated. You can slap an ESG label on anything, including like Exxon stock. But despite that, investors have continued to make these ESG offerings. He wants to securitize these equipment leases for heat pumps in low-income homes and sell them as part of a national ESG portfolio. They're also producing on the blockchain something they're calling environmental justice carbon offset tokens.
Oh boy.
Which are, basically, big polluters can come in and say, you know, we're investing in reducing emissions in low-income housing, which it's not yet clear that they're doing. I asked Block Power for examples of successful projects they've completed, and they declined. But I think the offset token industry itself is pretty dubious. But I think, like, the biggest reason that private investors are getting interested in still relatively low profits in this new energy industry is that they see that the whole energy system is being overhauled. And right now they're less interested in taking a really big slice of profits than they are in exercising control over the design of the new system that's coming into being. So, for example, in my interview with Block Power's CEO, who's, by the way, super charismatic guy, has received tons of positive press coverage, he talked about how a big part of their model is collecting detailed data on household energy consumption. And he talked about this, there are kind of long-running proposals for something called virtual power plants. The idea is that if households could tweak the time of day when they're consuming energy or make different like micro tweaks to energy consumption, like running their toaster oven or their dishwasher at a different time of day, that could, at the aggregate level across the grid, lead to significant energy savings. Now, on one hand, that's a promising model, and like optimizing the time of day that households are consuming energy.
Is it though? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm getting there. I mean, if it were run by a benevolent god who came in and did this in the interest of low-income houses, it could actually save them money and potentially even they could get money back. But what we're talking about here is a tech startup with a bunch of powerful investors getting a stake in when low-income families use their toaster. A friend said to me, this is real. This is the future liberals want energy.
Exactly. Well, there is that paternalism element that is troubling and also gives climate policy a bad name. And at the same, but the reason it gives it a bad name is because there's a for-profit model undercurrent to it that is troubling because if climate policy is going to be built on the back of, you know, maximizing returns for investors, the breadth of it is going to be severely undercut. I mean, I want to return to something you said about them packaging these pumps and then selling them. Like, they're packaging the energy cost savings from these pumps in low-income housing and selling that to investors. How does that work?
Okay, so yeah, it's sort of counterintuitive to think of because they're talking about profiting from savings on future energy expenditures. So big energy systems like universities have done this for a long time. Something called an ESCO will come in and offer a deal for a building owner to pay what he was expecting to pay over the next 10 years in energy costs. But the ESCO will come in and make the building more energy efficient, and then pocket the savings or pocket some portion of the savings. But here, and maybe that makes sense, you know, for a university or whatever, but we're doing this huge public investment that has been marketed as not only being good for the climate, but also being good because it means energy savings for regular consumers. And it seems to me that if that's true, even if there's an upfront cost of capital and the energy savings pay for that, then the consumers should still be able to pocket the energy savings. This is totally possible to design with something like a nonprofit ESCO, you right. know, a government run agency that just
The user of the energy as opposed to being right. outsourced to a for-profit model for investors.
But instead, we're doing this on the balance sheet of Goldman and giving them considerable control in the process.
That is immensely concerning. I mean, so in terms of control, what does that look like, right? Go ahead.
We are still in the pretty early stages, and a lot of this is going through startups like Block Power, which is a really big player in this space, which is signing individual contracts with different cities. So we don't know a lot about the specifics of what these deals will look like yet, but my point has kind of been, rather than some big federal agency negotiating on behalf of the public and making sure that these deals are struck according to really favorable terms, you have cities with kind of huge asymmetries of information trying to negotiate with this kind of shady startup that they don't know a lot about. These deals might be different city to city. And then the prices that they give consumers vary from house to house. Their whole model is that they specifically analyze the risk of doing a rehab project at a given house, and then they give kind of individually negotiated leases to these different homes. So those could be on, but you're just basically trusting Block Power to give people good deals. And it seems to me that the kind of logic should be completely flipped, that if we are bringing in private finance because of the scale of the investment needed, the government should be extremely vigilant in making sure that these deals are consistent, transparent, that the public knows exactly what's going on.
But that's part of why, and you write about this, they're targeting mid-sized to smaller cities, and that asymmetry benefits Wall Street.
Yeah, it's a good point. A lot of these cities don't have the resources to vet deals thoroughly or really understand the contracts they're signing. So I think this will be a thing to watch in the next couple of months, because the design of the IRA, not just in home retrofits, kind of across the board, is about striking these big partnerships with private investors. But who's analyzing the terms of those deals? It's really diffuse, with a ton of opportunity for fraud and corruption, and just for Wall Street to make off with incredibly high profits.
I want to return to the low-income housing angle to this, because this country is desperately in need of low-income housing. There's been, for decades at this point, a federal kind of moratorium on funding for new public housing. And yet, this is the form that it's coming in now. I mean, that's a bit concerning given the desperate need for low-income housing that this kind of retrofitting is now tied to a for-profit model.
That's a good point. I don't know, and I wonder what kind of effect it'll have on building housing. I mean, in some ways, it's easier to build, whether you're doing it publicly or privately, new housing stock that's energy efficient. But it's really hard and expensive and complicated to go into old housing stock. And so many cities have aging housing that hasn't been upgraded in decades and retrofit it to be clean and less polluting.
Yeah, right, exactly. So returning to Ithaca, do you see this model being replicated more broadly in other cities? And what are the larger scale concerns that you have about this kind of taking hold elsewhere?
I think the long-term question is that it's kind of no longer a question whether major institutions of private finance will be involved in the energy transition. They're kind of the model we've chosen to go with, as I said at the start, right, is not this robust public Green New Deal that's about investing in local workforces and union labor and all the way up through the supply chain. But instead about striking, you know, bringing in most of the capital from the private sector. So at that point, I think the responsibility of the public will just be oversight and making sure that they're not getting fleeced in these deals. And so far, I don't think that's happening.
I hear that. Lee Harris, staff writer at the American Prospect. Please read this piece. It's fascinating. Wall Street's big bet on rewiring America. And I'm looking forward to more from you at the American Prospect, one of our favorite places to highlight here on the Majority Report. So really appreciate your time today, Lee.
Thanks so much, Emma. Bye-bye.
Of course. All right. Well, with that, we are going to head into the fun half of this program. First, we rely on your support here at the Majority Report. We really do. So please become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com if you like our work. You saw the terms of that Crowder contract. This is David versus Goliath here.
It is baby. Funny. I mean, just to dwell on that a little bit, like I've been thinking about this because whenever we got, especially around the Ethan Klein thing, you know, the Crowder fans would be like, well, you guys only have 1.2 million subscribers. Crowder has 6 million.
Yeah.
Motherfucker, you have 50 times the operating budget.
50 times. I mean, like, I don't want to go into what I make, but it's many figures below that.
Wait, hold on. I Googled your net worth, Emma. I thought I'm pretty positive.
Yeah, well. Yeah. I mean, Matt, we know, is like, rolling in.
Look, I have, I forget what it said, like, without any sort of lingering doubts, I've accumulated $1.5 million. Which, that would be nice.
Right. Anyway, but please become a member. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Fund our lives. That would be helpful. And today on ESVN, youtube.com/ESVN show, we will be giving our picks for the conference championships, which, I mean, these are the four teams that deserve to be there. And it's really, really exciting time for football. Plus, we'll be talking, and I will be getting Bradley's first reactions to Nathaniel Hackett being hired as the Jets offensive coordinator. And if it means Aaron Rodgers will be actually traded to New York, that would be a media firestorm that I don't even know if the city will still be afloat at that point. YouTube.com/ESPN show. Matt?
Yeah, I did a solo Left Reckoning on Tuesday evening. It got censored.
Oh, no.
Because I played that clip of Jimmy Fallon and Paris Hilton
people.
And, you know, I'll just say, like, we're on YouTube. YouTube's sort of supposed lip service to fair use is all a marketing lie. It has nothing to do with their legal department. The idea that, first of all, copyright should be against the First Amendment. The only reason it's not is because there's a subsequent clause that says you allow a limited monopoly over an expression of an idea. We were not expressing the idea that you should all go out and get gorilla NFTs. We were criticizing it and documenting it as a scam, and nonetheless, the episode got pulled off YouTube. It might be back up. It takes a long time for it to scrub that stuff, but you can find it on YouTube or on Spotify, the video as well. Rosa Luxemburg, Part 2, Reform and Revolution for patrons, patreon.com/leftreckoning, David Griscom, and I'll be discussing that on Sunday.
Awesome. Yeah, I mean, well, then Patreon. Can you still see it on Patreon? Or no?
It's it's public, so it's on Spotify, and we posted the YouTube link to Patreon, so that might be back up there now, but you can.
Gotcha.
It's all free on Spotify.
Bring the boys in. Yeah. Let's bring... what's it? Thursdays are for the boys, plus me. What's up, guys? We're going to set up your shop, but... we can hear you. I can hear you. There. Wow.
It's all the boys today.
Quick work. Yeah. The boys. And
hello.
And me, the hall monitor. What's happening on Doomed and Scam Economy, Bender?
Sure. So on Doomed this past Tuesday, I had on Lance from the Serfs, and we talked all about what's been going on with Steven Crowder and the Daily Wire and Ben Shapiro and their whole kerfuffle and what that means for conservative media. And then on Scam Economy, I had on Ed Zitron to talk about the latest crypto lending company to lose all their customers' money, Gemini Earn, which is run by the Winklevoss twins. So definitely check both of those out. Video at youtube.com/MattBinder and podcasts at doomedcast.com and scameconomy.com.
I'm a big Ed Zitron fan. I think he was on. I either produced a show for that Australian guy who made Joe Rogan look stupid, or it was a Michael Brooks. Might have been Zeps, yeah. But I think I produced a thing with Zitron on. But he's a very good reporter, and you have him on a lot, Bender, don't you?
Yeah. He's like a. I think he's a PR guy who runs like this newsletter, pretty much. And the newsletter is really blown up. And he has got really good takes on basically the media business, tech, the crypto, just basically that whole industry.
He's a good mix of smart and funny.
Huh. Yes, he's very funny. Yes.
All right, we'll check that out.
I can co-sign that. I've actually, before I logged on to join this episode, I was listening to the episode of Scam Economy, so I can co-sign that it's quite good. I will not be listening to this episode of The Majority Report, obviously, though I am on it.
I mean, you got to watch the tape back to see what you can do better, Brandon. Mm. That's I don't do that either. Anyway,
yeah, they say you should do that, but I'm not that dedicated. I can't.
I listen back at 0.75 speed, thinking like, oh, this is where I could have interrupted a little bit sooner.
I didn't quite go on long enough.
On the flip side, I re-listened to it in slow motion. I really take in what was said on the show.
Oh, there you go. I mean, much more sensitive than new Matt here. Brandon, what's happening on the discourse, if anything? Yes.
No. I've actually started again. I've have a new strategy. We're going strong. We're going to keep going strong. I'm going to be recording a politics episode this weekend. Don't know what has happened yet because I can't see the future. And also going to do an episode on Avatar 2, Electric Boogaloo. What is the subtitle of Avatar 2? The Way of the Water?
Mm-hmm. No, it's Electric Boogaloo.
Okay, perfect. So Avatar 2, Electric Boogaloo, and
Avatar 2, episode. The blue is back, bitch.
Blue is the warmest color. Avatar 2. And so, those episodes will be out sometime this weekend.
All right, great. I'm curious to hear your thoughts about Avatar, but maybe that's
like
for the fun half.
Somehow.
Interesting. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflakes has what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
Sam Cedar. What a fucking nightmare.
Can we bring back DJ Denner?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. Hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. Back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on. To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.